Chavez accused Bush of trying to assassinate him. He seemed actually to believe it. However, reassuring the United States, he also said there were no circumstances in which he would cut off oil, except in case of any other aggression by the U.S. administration. Then and only then would he cut off the supply. He complained that the U.S. media demonized him by showing only photographs of him with Saddam Hussein, Fidel Castro, and Muammar Gaddafi. They never showed pictures of him, he said, with Pope John Paul II or with Bill Clinton. At the end of our interview, Chavez spoke a little broken English, assuring, "The people of the United States, all the women, all the men, we Venezuelan people love you. We want to be your brother. I love very much a great leader of you. Martin Luther King is my leader. His dream, Martin Luther King's dream, is your dream, is our dream, is my dream." When we left his office, he pumped the hand of every member of our group, cameramen, bodyguards, and producers. In December 2007, he lost a referendum that would have given him an indefinite term in office and even more power. Still, as things stand now, Chavez may have many years ahead to accomplish whatever his dream may be. Like his mentor Castro, he wants a socialist Latin America, thinks our democracy is a mistake, and will try to prevent it from happening in the other countries of his hemisphere. He has already begun to nationalize some of Venezuela's industries, like telecommunications, electricity, and oil. He says he will leave private property alone. Perhaps. And he says he looks forward to good relations with the next president of the United States. One more thing. He drinks 20 cups of coffee a day. Adventures with the Most Mysterious Men. The interview that got me in the most trouble began innocently enough in the summer of 1986, on a yacht in the south of France. Merv and I were on our honeymoon, and through a friend of Merv's, we were invited for lunch aboard the Nabila, the opulent yacht owned by Adnan Khashoggi, who knew that within months Khashoggi would become a central figure in the Iran-Contra scandal that tarred the Reagan administration and almost cost me my job. At the time, we knew Khashoggi only by reputation. He was a rich, very rich, Saudi wheeler dealer who had made millions brokering the multi-billion dollar sale of American weapons to Saudi Arabia in the 60s and 70s. That, plus other deals, had earned him the reputation of being one of the world's richest men, and the biggest spender. Judging from his yacht, it was true. The $70 million 280-foot floating palace he'd named after his only daughter had its own helicopter and landing pad, marble bathrooms with gold fixtures, 11 VIP suites, each named for a semi-precious gem like garnet or topaz, a barber shop, and mirrored massage rooms. The ship was wired with cutting-edge technology that might not seem like much today, but back then was unheard of. Everything in the master suites was operated by remote control. A button to lock and unlock the door, a button to unveil the TV, a button in Khashoggi's own stateroom that swung open the back wall of the shower to reveal a secret staircase leading, presumably, to a safe room. The Nabila even had a state-of-the-art operating room with a closed-circuit TV system that enabled the doctors aboard to be in visual contact with doctors anywhere in the world. At lunch, we learned one way he'd managed to accumulate such wealth. Would I, or any of his other guests, Khashoggi asked, like to visit his onboard Hindu mystic, Sri Chandra Swamiji Maharaj, or for short, Swamiji? Swamiji could see into the future, Khashoggi told us, and read people's minds. I bit, having never met a true Swami before, and was escorted after lunch to a much smaller cabin where the Swami was sitting on the floor in the lotus position, playing with his toes. There was another man in the room, in an ill-fitting suit, who was described as the Swami's translator, but I paid no attention to him. The Swami had such an aura of calm about him that I poured out all the trouble I was having with my daughter at the time, hoping for some Swami wisdom. Well, I didn't get much wisdom. Nor, I discovered months later, did anyone else Khashoggi dispatched to the Swami. Turned out that he offered an audience with his guru to anyone with whom he was doing business in the hope that he would eventually reveal his personal and business concerns. The so-called translator would then relay them to Khashoggi. Merv and I liked Khashoggi. He was pleasant, quite small and plump, and looked somewhat like one of those blow-up toys you push over that bounce right back. We accepted his invitation to return for dinner that night, where, among the guests, was the flamboyant former Prime Minister of Canada, Pierre Trudeau. We had another luxurious meal on the Nabila, but that was that. We didn't see Khashoggi again. 4 months later, the Iran-Contra scandal burst into the headlines and threatened to severely damage the Reagan administration. Reported first in a Lebanese newspaper, then on the front pages of every U.S. newspaper, was a labyrinthine tale about the Reagan administration violating its own policy by secretly selling weapons to Iran in return for the release of American hostages being held in Lebanon. Soon afterward, it was disclosed that proceeds from the covert arms sales were secretly and illegally going to support the anti-communist insurgents in Nicaragua. And who was the mysterious middleman who was thought to have brokered the arms deal? Khashoggi. What a story. Since I knew him, I started tracking down Khashoggi all over the world to see if I could interview him for 2020. Finding him was a challenge. He had a huge ranch in Kenya, as well as homes in Marbella, Paris, Cannes, the Canary Islands, Madrid, Rome, Beirut, Riyadh, Jeddah, Monte Carlo, and a $30 million apartment in New York. When I finally managed to reach him, he was pleasant enough, but non-committal. He didn't say yes, but he also didn't say no. So I'd wait a bit, then phone him again. He called me back unexpectedly while Merv and I were at La Costa, Merv's spa and golf resort in California. Khashoggi told me he was sending me some material by air that he wanted me to read. His personal messenger hand-delivered the package the next day. Enclosed was a copy of a letter he'd sent to Robert McFarlane, Reagan's national security adviser in 1985, suggesting that there were moderate elements in Iran that wanted to open communication with the United States. Most interesting was that McFarlane personally answered him, thanking him for his interest. Lots of people sent ideas about a lot of subjects to the White House, but few received responses from such a senior member of the administration. Khashoggi was confirming to me his personal relationship with the highest level in the Reagan administration. I got the message. What I didn't understand was a copy of a lecture he also sent me, presented by former CBS News president Fred Friendly at Columbia University. This lecture dealt with the dilemma faced by reporters who uncovered information that might prove dangerous to the country if made public. Was Khashoggi warning me, or was he asking me if I could keep a secret? I didn't have a clue. The next time I called him, I asked him about the lecture. Instead of answering me, he agreed to an interview. "I'll come see you," he said. 3 days later, he arrived at La Costa. "Do you have a secure phone?" he asked, after we had exchanged pleasantries. The answer was no, we weren't in the business of state secrets, but we were about to be. "We have our own phone line in the cottage," I told Khashoggi. "Is there an extension?" he asked. "Yes," I said, "in the bathroom." "I'm going to call someone. You don't need to know who," he told me. "Listen on the extension, but don't make a sound." So there was Khashoggi on the phone in the living room, and there was I on the extension in the bathroom, sitting on the lid of the toilet. And he was talking arms sales with another mystery man. "How much did we get for this? $7 million? Good. And how much did we get for the toes? $2 million. I didn't have a paper and pen with me, so I grabbed an eyebrow pencil, ripped the top off the tissue box, and started scribbling notes as fast as I could. I didn't know from toes then, TOWS, but I know now it stands for tube-launched optically tracked wire-guided missile. I wrote toes, T-O-E-S, in my notes, and wondered what feet had to do with all this. The conversation lasted far longer than the tissue box, but I got the point. Khashoggi was proving to me that he was indeed the middleman in the U.S.-Iranian arms deal. The interview, he said now, would have to wait. "Someday I'll take you to meet the man who was behind the whole thing," he assured me. "Then you'll have your story." Someday is a horrible word to a journalist. Too much can happen waiting for someday, mainly that someone else will break the story. So I stuck close to Khashoggi. After we both returned to New York from California, I spent hours with him and his then-wife, Lamia, in their vast Fifth Avenue apartment. 16 apartments folded into one, including an Olympic-sized swimming pool. In December, after I had spent weeks courting his confidence, Khashoggi suddenly told me he was ready to do the interview. And the adventure began that got me in so much trouble. It was all very tidy at the beginning. We scheduled the interview for a Wednesday afternoon in Khashoggi's apartment, which would give me and my producer, Martin Clancy, ample time to edit the piece for Thursday night's 2020 broadcast. But the night before the interview, Khashoggi phoned from Las Vegas to announce a change in plan. "I've decided I don't want to do the interview in New York," he said. "I'm going to Monte Carlo, and I'll take you with me on my plane. We'll do the interview there." "Okay," I said, "but I'll be bringing my producer and a crew of 6. "Good," Khashoggi replied firmly. Merv then weighed in. "I don't like the sound of the whole thing," he said. "I'm going with you." And the crew became 7. Very early Thursday morning, 3 a.m. in fact, we took off from Newark Airport aboard Khashoggi's private DC-8. The plane turned out to be an airborne version of his yacht. The seats were covered in cream-colored chamois and silk, the seat belts had gold-plated buckles, and Khashoggi's private chef served us breakfast on china monogrammed with the initials AK in gold. The first part of our interview with Khashoggi took place on the plane on December 11th. We planned to do the second part at his apartment in Monte Carlo. We had no time to spare because Martin and I intended to feed the complete interview by satellite back to New York for the 10 p.m. broadcast that night. And so the explosive interview began at 30,000 feet, the jet engines whistling in the background, with Khashoggi dressed in a caftan. For the first time, a face was put on the Arms for Hostages scandal rocking the Reagan administration. An Arab face with an Arab accent, describing the clandestine deal between Robert McFarlane and moderates in the Iranian regime, trying to get the U.S. hostages in Lebanon released in exchange for U.S. weapons. Iran was 6 years into a bloody war with Iraq. He also confirmed the establishment of a Swiss bank account to shelter some $30 million received from the Iranians for the weapons. The account was controlled by top national security officials in the Reagan administration, who were siphoning the money off to illegally fund the Contra rebels fighting the communist regime in Nicaragua. I was totally amazed by what I was hearing, but there was still a missing piece. The actual arms dealer was an Iranian businessman named Manusher Gorbanifar, a shadowy figure who operated so far below the radar, no one even had a photograph of him. "I'm taking you to see Gorbanifar," Khashoggi said when we landed in Nice, France. Now I was really flabbergasted. The interview with Khashoggi was a coup in itself, but Gorbanifar too? The man whose telephone conversation I'd listened in on in the bathroom at La Costa? The man with the toes? Merv looked quite nervous about the whole thing, but without skipping a beat, we immediately boarded Khashoggi's waiting helicopters, we needed 2 to transport us all, and flew to Monte Carlo. Gorbanifar was startled, to say the least, when he arrived at Khashoggi's apartment. He was expecting to see Khashoggi privately, not an American television crew. Heaven knows what power Khashoggi held over Gorbanifar, but basically, he told the arms dealer to do the interview, and Gorbanifar immediately sat down with me, sweating profusely. His motive behind everything was no more complicated than making a sound business deal, he told me. New weapons for Iran would help secure a victory over Iraq and a potentially profitable peace from which both he and his business partner, Khashoggi, would benefit. $2 billion a day, he projected. According to Gorbanifar, the weapons for hostages deal had worked. He claimed he had negotiated the release of three hostages, including Benjamin Weir, a Presbyterian minister. What he did not mention were the new hostages being captured as replacements. With this news, the interview came to a close. Martin and I raced back to our hotel to edit the interviews. He edited Gurbanifar, and I edited the Khashoggi interview we had done on the plane. We'd been up for more than 24 hours by then and were punch drunk with exhaustion. We finally finished at 3 a.m., Monte Carlo time, which made it 9 p.m. in New York. We had to wake up a grumpy French technician to transmit the interview, the final portion of which arrived 15 minutes before 2020 went on the air. There was obviously no time for ABC to promote it or even preview it. They just ran it cold, and it made a huge splash. Ted Koppel picked up the interviews on Nightline, and the story made all the newspapers the next day. I was sleeping it off in Monte Carlo. Merv was wonderful. When I finally came to, he proposed spending a romantic weekend in Paris. A lovely idea that never happened. Khashoggi called and said in a rushed voice that Gurbanifar was coming to his apartment at 2 p.m. with an urgent message that he wanted me to deliver to President Reagan. We must meet with him, he said. Our flight to Paris wasn't until the late afternoon, so I agreed. I assumed the message would be in a sealed envelope I could easily get to the White House. It wasn't. And this is where I got into deep trouble. Gurbanifar, very composed without a television camera on him and not sweating at all, opened the conversation with a startling projection. I am going to tell you everything, because I might be killed, and someone must know the true story, he said. I know your president is being pressured not to have anything to do with Iran, but I want you to tell him that he must keep the door open. If he does, I believe I can have another hostage released on Christmas Eve, maybe even two. As this is a matter of life and death, no one except the president must know about it. If the story gets out, the hostages will not be released, I will be killed, and my family in Iran will be killed also. I swallowed hard and all but choked. I couldn't believe it. Gurbanifar was going to tell me the entire story of his role in Iran-Contra, or Irangate, as some were calling it. This big scoop was falling into my lap. I got out the little notebook I always carry to take notes, and Gurbanifar launched into an endless story of high-level deceit and betrayal. Part of it concerned his ally, Ayatollah Montasseri, a moderate who was among those in line to succeed the ailing Ayatollah Khomeini, who had led the Islamic Revolution against the Shah. Unlike the West-hating Khomeini, Montasseri wanted to restore relations with America and the West. The arms deal, which had been struck with McFarlane and Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, then an aide to the National Security Council, would have given the pro-Western Montasseri enough prestige to cement the succession. Three or four arms shipments had taken place, but some included faulty parts. The deal had temporarily fallen apart, Montasseri had been discredited, and Gurbanifar's own life was in danger. Adding insult to injury, when the shipments resumed, the Americans tried to cut Gurbanifar out of the deal. It was then, he said, and only to protect himself, that he had personally given the sensational story of the Arms for Hostages scheme to the Lebanese newspaper. These tidy paragraphs do not represent in the slightest the time it took Gurbanifar to tell me the saga. At one point I thought, what the hell am I doing here? I filled my little notebook, then moved on to Khashoggi's stationery. When my pen went dry, I began using pencils. When Khashoggi's stationery ran out, I started writing on whatever scrap of paper I could find, and still Gurbanifar went on. Merv sat there silently next to me, as afternoon became evening, and evening became night, getting up only occasionally to cancel plane reservations to Paris and make new ones. Finally, Gurbanifar finished telling his story. It was 4 a.m., by that time, Merv and I were so exhausted, we'd given up any thought about spending a romantic weekend together. We checked back into the hotel and slept for an entire day. I pieced together my notes as best I could when we got back to New York. What a fantastic story, but how much of it could I use? Gorbanifar had made it clear that if I publicly revealed certain portions of it or identified him as my source, the hostages would not be released, and he and his family might be killed. I understood now why Khashoggi had sent me Fred Friendly's lecture. How much of what Gorbanifar had told me did I have to tell ABC? And what about the message Gorbanifar wanted me to deliver to the president? Resist pressure, keep talking to Iran, send more arms. The hostages will not be released if you don't. There are other lives at stake. I knew the rules. A reporter is not supposed to become personally involved in a story, and certainly not be allowed to act as a messenger. But like it or not, I was involved. I didn't want anybody's blood on my hands, so I decided to honor Gorbanifar's demand for secrecy. But how to get to Reagan? Though I'd interviewed the president several times, I really had no personal relationship with him. I couldn't just call the White House and say, "I'd like to talk to the president, please. I have an important message for him." Well, I suppose I could have, but I was afraid that I'd have to speak to 6 aides along the way who would want to know what this was all about. And then it came to me. Nancy Reagan could be the conduit to her husband. I couldn't call Mrs. Reagan cold at the White House, but we had a mutual friend, Jerry Zipkin, who was very close to her. They talked, I heard, almost daily. I telephoned Jerry. "I know this sounds odd, Jerry, but I need to talk to Mrs. Reagan. I'm involved in a very serious matter, and I need to talk to her as soon as possible. Can you telephone her at the White House and ask her to call me?" An hour later, Mrs. Reagan called. "I'm in a very strange position," I said to her. "I have some important information for the president." I told her the entire story, concluding, "I have no idea how accurate this material is, but I was asked to make sure the president got it himself." While we were speaking, I heard a click on the line. "Ronnie, is that you?" Mrs. Reagan asked. It was, so I repeated the story to the president. He then gave me specific instructions about how to send my written material to him at the White House. I followed those instructions, and that was the last I heard from anyone in the administration. A week or so later, Merv and I took my daughter to Hawaii for Christmas. On Christmas Eve, I sat in front of the television set, waiting for a news bulletin announcing that a hostage had been released. There was no bulletin. Someone, somewhere along the clandestine line, had failed. Was it our side? Was it Gorbanifar? I never knew and could not find out. I thought I was through with my part of the Iran-Contra scandal. 2 investigations had been launched. 1, a congressional committee headed by former Senator John Tower, and another by a special prosecutor, Lawrence Walsh. But a month or so after I'd spoken to Reagan, a story appeared in the New York Times about the release of unspecified documents pertaining to the Arms for Hostages deal. Concerned that my name might eventually surface, I sat down with Rune Arledge and Dick Wald, the senior vice president of ABC News, and went through the entire saga from beginning to end. I gave them a copy of the memo I'd relayed to the White House about Gorbanifar, that he'd said his life was in danger, that a hostage might be released if Reagan acted on his message. Rune and Dick decided I would report key elements of the story on the evening newscast without naming Gorbanifar as the source. So I did, enabling ABC to scoop the other networks on the story. That would have been that, had the Wall Street Journal not picked up the story again in March 1987, this time naming me, titled, "Iran Arms Dealer Used Barbara Walters to Secretly Pass on a Message to Reagan." The story reported that my memo about Gorbanifar had been circulated among the editors at ABC News, and that I had sent the memo to the White House without prior approval from the network. The phone rang. "Please come to my office," came the cold voice of David Burke, an ABC News executive who was more or less the official watchdog for policy and procedure. "We'd like to talk to you." It was not a pleasant meeting. Burke was stern and angry. In front of a very uncomfortable Dick Wald, Burke told me the network was going to publicly reprimand me for violating ABC News regulations that prohibit any employee of the news division from giving material to any government agency without the prior knowledge and approval of ABC News. The only exceptions were life and death situations, in which correspondents were allowed to use their own judgment. I was stunned. As far as I'm concerned, David, this was a matter of life and death, and I did use my best judgment, I said. Why don't I just explain to the press that Gorbanifar told me his life was in danger and that if Reagan acted, a hostage was supposed to be released? But he would have none of it. I was publicly reprimanded. Barbara Walters' transmission of her information to the president was in violation of a literal interpretation of news policy, read in part, ABC's statement to the press. ABC News policy expressly limits journalistic cooperation with government agencies unless threats to human life are involved. Ms. Walters believed that to be the case. Just about every newspaper and magazine in the country carried this story. Barbara Walters gave Reagan papers on Iran, headlined the New York Times, as if I'd been a major participant in the Iran-Contra affair. Walters, as courier criticized, chimed in the Los Angeles Times, while a slightly kinder USA Today headlined its story, "Walters Takes Heat for Iran Memo to Reagan." A cartoon in the New York Post even had Ayatollah Khomeini sitting behind a desk over the words, "Good evening and welcome to 2020. Barbara Walters and I have swapped jobs." In retrospect, I should have showed Roone and Dick and also David Burke the Gorbanifar material sooner. At the time, I was worried that somehow it would leak out, possibly leading to Gorbanifar's death. But I still would have sent that report to the White House in the hope that a hostage would be released. I also think that ABC was wrong in reprimanding me, and I was hurt, especially because neither Roone nor Dick Wald defended me. They said it was David Burke's territory and left the decision to him. From my point of view, the news department certainly had no qualms about using the material I provided. I honestly believed that lives were at stake, which justified the exception in ABC's news policy. I eventually made my peace with Roone and Dick. As for David Burke, we rarely talked, and eventually he left ABC News to head CBS News. Ironically, there turned out to be more than the lives of the hostages at stake. Robert McFarlane, who had resigned as National Security Advisor in 1985, but privately continued his role in Iran-Contra at President Reagan's request, attempted suicide in 1987 by overdosing on Valium. Shortly after he was released from the hospital, I was the first to interview him and his wife, Jonda. McFarlane told me he felt he had failed the country. Charges were leveled at several members of the Reagan administration for their roles in Iran-Contra, including McFarlane, who pled guilty to withholding information from Congress. Oliver North and Admiral John Poindexter, McFarlane's successor as head of the National Security Council, were convicted of various offenses, but their convictions would be overturned on technicalities. Reagan's Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, would also be indicted, but George H.W. Bush, who succeeded Ronald Reagan as president, pardoned him before he stood trial. Bush would also grant pardons to McFarlane, to former Assistant Secretary of State Elliot Abrams, and to three high-level members of the CIA. So everyone involved in the Iran-Contra scandal got away with it, including Khashoggi and Gorbanifar. I remained in occasional touch with Khashoggi, who continued to wheel and deal. I would interview him again in 1990 when he was indicted, along with Imelda Marcos, whom I would also talk with, for helping to conceal hundreds of millions of dollars in assets she and her husband, Ferdinand Marcos, the deposed president of the Philippines, had allegedly stolen from their country. Both were subsequently acquitted. Khashoggi would have other scrapes with the law, but the last I heard, he was living quietly in Monte Carlo, perhaps with his swami, but definitely without his yacht. He had sold it years before to Donald Trump, who subsequently passed it on to a Saudi businessman. I never heard from Gorbanifar again, though he too may still be playing his international games. At one point, his name surfaced in connection with the Pentagon and his ongoing quest for a regime change in Iran. According to Newsweek, Ghorbanifar claimed to know where Saddam Hussein hid $340 million in cash, half of which, he said, could be used to overthrow the Ayatollahs. As for the American hostages held in Lebanon, one of whom, journalist Terry Anderson, was held for nearly 7 years, they were finally released in 1991. Along with every other American, I was happy their ordeal had ended. That also ended my foray into global diplomacy. Murderers. In my business, crime always pays. Give us a good rape, give us a good murder, and we are guaranteed a successful broadcast. I don't mean to sound frivolous or cold-hearted, but the more sensational the crime, the higher the ratings. So you won't be surprised to learn that during my 25 years at 2020, I interviewed almost every important murderer, alleged or convicted, if a murderer can be considered important. Almost all had committed such horrifying crimes that they made sensational headlines. Consider Arthur Seale, who in 1992, along with his wife Irene, kidnapped Sidney Riso, the president of Exxon International, locked him in a box in an unventilated storage unit in New Jersey, and demanded ransom. When Riso died 4 days later, the couple secretly buried him and continued to press for the ransom. Or Jeremy Strohmeyer, a handsome 18-year-old former honor roll high school student who in 1997 sexually molested and strangled a 7-year-old girl in the ladies' room of a gambling casino in Nevada. Or Rabbi Fred Newlander, who had been widely respected at his well-attended affluent temple in New Jersey, until he had an affair of fatal attraction proportions in 1994 and hired two hitmen to kill his wife of 29 years. They bludgeoned her to death with a lead pipe. The rabbi is currently serving 30 years to life. Arthur Seale and Strohmeyer are incarcerated forever without parole. Seale's wife, Irene, is serving a lesser sentence of 20 years because she cooperated with the police and led them to Riso's grave. The process of securing an interview with accused murderers or convicted murderers like these is often long and arduous. First of all, you can't do it unless the prisoner agrees and makes it known to the proper authority. On our part, this then requires a lot of petitioning and many phone calls for official permission to whoever is in charge, be it the warden, the sheriff, or the state superintendent of prisons. Once at the prison, you have to leave whatever you are carrying, pocketbook, wallet, mirror, and so on, before you enter the restricted area. You are not allowed to bring in gifts, even books or magazines. Sometimes you can bring in a certain number of quarters that the prisoner, provided he or she is in the common visiting room, can use to buy candy, hamburgers, or soft drinks from vending machines. These are eagerly accepted. I've visited many prisons all over the country, once touring an execution room with its equipment for lethal injections. Whenever I make one of these visits, for whatever the reason, I am haunted for days after. I hear the noises in my head from the prisoners as I've walked down the halls, the shuffle of the shackled legs, the clang of the lockup gates behind me. When I leave the prison, I take deep gulps of fresh air. I never say, "There but for the grace of God go I," but I do say, "Thank God I am free." The prisoner I've just interviewed, no matter how hideous the crime he or she has committed, has become a real person to me, and I have to clear my head. The fact that I can sometimes feel empathy for someone who has brutally killed another human being doesn't mean that I can understand the murder. But at the time I am sitting opposite the killer, I am not judgmental. I don't say, "How could you be such a monster?" I do, however, say, "There are people who think you are a monster. How do you respond to that?" During the actual interview, I'm not feeling a lot of emotion. It is when I leave that the force of the crime hits me. Why, I ask myself. Most of these killers, when you meet them, are mild-mannered, polite, articulate. Some, like the rabbi, still claim their innocence, but most of the convicted murderers I've interviewed express great regret. Of the many murder cases I've been involved in, five stand out in my mind. The most intriguing murderer turned out not to be one. When I first sat down with the mysterious and debonair Klaus von Bülow in 1982, he had been convicted 1 month earlier of twice trying to murder his very wealthy wife, Sunny, who was then in a coma and remains in a vegetative state to this day. His weapon was a hypodermic needle, which the jury believed he had used to inject Sunny von Bülow with insulin, a potentially fatal drug for his wife, who had a serious low blood sugar condition. The case had ignited worldwide attention, given Sunny von Bülow's fortune of $75 million. The testimony against von Bülow by his stepchildren, a prince and princess of Austrian nobility, and Klaus's attractive lover, Alexandra Iles. Iles had cut off her relationship with von Bülow on the advice of her attorneys when he was indicted. Von Bülow himself had not testified at the trial, and everybody in the media, both print and television, was scrambling for an exclusive interview with him to hear his side of the story. I had no particular entree to von Bülow and never thought I'd get the interview were he to give one. So I was surprised when I received a call soon after his conviction from Andrea Reynolds, von Bülow's advisor and current lover. She had something to tell me, Mrs. Reynolds said. Would I please come see her at the von Bülow's Fifth Avenue apartment? I was cool in more ways than one when I arrived. I didn't know what the something was that Mrs. Reynolds wanted to tell me, plus the fact that it was a foul, cold day and I'd ruined my new suede boots in a puddle of slush. Von Bülow's apartment was opulent and in one of Fifth Avenue's grandest buildings, but I'd seen opulent before. Mrs. Reynolds invited me to have tea in the library, and while I was sitting there, mourning my boots, in walked the tall, smiling Klaus von Bülow. He shook my hand, sat down, and began to talk about a mutual friend of ours, an Englishman. He acted as if we were dinner partners who were meeting for the first time, so I did too. How is he and how is the family? I responded politely about our friend. And yes, I'd like another cup of tea. Then he very calmly, quietly explained what his situation was. His sentencing was 2 weeks away. His appeal of the guilty verdict, if accepted, even further away, and the prosecution, fearing he was a flight risk, wanted to imprison him. He impressed upon me that he was very devoted to his and Sonny's only child, Cosima, and that he had no intention of skipping bail and abandoning her, that he wanted to correct the misrepresentations about him in the media and remain at home. I realized then I was auditioning for an exclusive interview. Why me and not everyone else clamoring for the opportunity? Because Andrea, who now asked me to call her by her first name, told me later that she had called the William Morris agency where she had a connection and asked who the best person would be to interview her lover, and the agency had said that I was. Von Bülow must have felt confident enough of her opinion and comfortable enough with me because I got the interview. The prosecutor who'd won the murder conviction was furious that I was going to give von Bülow his moment in the court of public opinion. Indeed, von Bülow seemed sincere and convincing during the interview about his loyalty to, if not love for, his wife, whom he described as the most beautiful woman, yet also a deeply unhappy person, with virtually no self-confidence. He admitted that the conflict they'd had over his work schedule had brought them in recent years to the brink of divorce. Sonny wanted him to spend the entire summer with her at their cottage in Newport, Rhode Island, as well as a month in Europe. He was also candid about the sexless relationship they'd had at Sonny's instigation ever since the birth of Cosima, by then a teenager, and their agreement that he could do what he wanted, but be discreet. But there remained the issue of his conviction for attempted murder. One final question, simply this, Mr. von Bülow. Did you try to kill your wife? I asked him. No, I did not, he replied. Our interview was over. I don't know whether this interview had anything to do with the outcome, but von Bülow was allowed to stay out on bail. Even better for him, after hiring the famous Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz, he was granted a new trial. In June 1985, the second jury declared von Bülow not guilty, based on new medical evidence and inconsistencies and conflicting testimony in the first trial. The one-time murderer was a free man, and soon afterward, I interviewed von Bülow again. He was as elegant and formal and mysterious as ever as we rehashed the trials. He reminded me of those British actors in old movies playing the master of the house, wearing a smoking jacket and velvet slippers. But what struck me the most about von Bülow was that at no time during our meetings and interviews did I hear him say, "This is a terrible thing that's happened to me." In all the time I spoke with him, he never complained. He never raised his voice. He never got emotional. He was a very cool character. He was not above the fury of his stepchildren, however, who remain convinced to this day that he murdered their mother. Alexander von Auersperg and Alla Knissel, now Isham, launched a civil suit against him after he was exonerated, and von Bülow, evidently fearing a loss this time, capitulated to their demands. He renounced any claim on their mother's estate and basically got out of town. Von Bülow now lives in London, attending dinner parties and occasionally writing theater and art reviews. Sunny, now in her 70s, remains comatose in a nursing home in New York. An aside, in the subsequent film about the von Bülows, Reversal of Fortune, Glenn Close played Sonny and Jeremy Irons played Klaus. Irons, whose portrayal earned him the Academy Award for Best Actor in 1991, told me he watched my interviews with von Bülow again and again to capture that sort of suave charm and reserved hauteur he had. Among the rumors about the mysterious von Bülow at the time was that he was a necrophiliac, which led to this exchange toward the end of the movie. Ron Silver, who played defense attorney Alan Dershowitz, says to Irons, "You're a very strange man." And Irons, a.k.a. von Bülow, responds, "You have no idea." And that's the way I felt about him. Indeed, a very strange man. The most dramatic prison interview I conducted was with actor Robert Blake, who was also charged with murdering his wife, but unlike von Bülow, was denied bail and had to spend almost a year in prison awaiting trial. When I interviewed him in Los Angeles County Jail in February 2003, the preliminary hearing had just begun on whether to free him on bail. The former Emmy-winning star of the 70s television series Beretta looked gaunt and seemed emotionally drained. Handcuffed and wearing a prison-issue orange jumpsuit, the 70-year-old actor had spent most of every day of the last year in solitary confinement, supposedly for his own protection, in the cell formerly occupied by O.J. Simpson. No wonder he looked as awful as he did. He was charged with shooting Bonnie Lee Bakley, his wife of less than 6 months and mother of his baby daughter, in the head on May 4, 2001, while she waited for him in a car after dinner near a restaurant in Studio City. Though he claimed he was still in the restaurant at the time she was shot, a year later, Blake was arrested for her murder. The incriminating evidence had come from two former stuntmen, both heavy drug users, who claimed Blake had hired them to kill her. Blake had been desperately trying to get on television ever since, not to plead his innocence, but to talk to his little daughter Rosie, whom he hadn't seen in a year. Two sets of his defense lawyers had quit his case, fearing that he might incriminate himself if he spoke in public. His third attorney also strenuously objected, but had not resigned. The last stumbling block was the Los Angeles County Jail, whose sheriff, Leroy Baca, had steadfastly refused to let any journalist, with or without the lawyer's approval, do an interview from the jail. But I had a reason to believe I could make him change his mind. By the way, this was the same Sheriff Baca who was in charge of Paris Hilton when she was sent to jail in 2007. I called him and asked if I could meet with him the next time I was in Los Angeles. We did, and the sheriff could not have been nicer, but said, "I can't give you permission. It's against regulations." And here is where I played my trump card. I'd interviewed prisoners there before, I pointed out. "Who?" he asked, startled. "When?" "In 1996, the Menendez brothers," I replied. "You'll read about them later." He hemmed and hawed and finally agreed to check it out. He had trouble believing I was right, but I was, and he relented. "There is a precedent," Sheriff Baca told me. "In that case, you can do it." Even though I was trying so hard to get his permission, I was still surprised when he gave it. So the scene was set for the sensational, touching, hilarious, wild, peculiar interview with Blake. He cried at times, was hostile at others, talked directly to his 2-year-old daughter, and, in general, acted as if he were still acting. Blake was convinced he'd be convicted and never see his daughter again. When I asked him what he wanted to say to Rosie, his eyes brimmed with tears. "Life is a spectacular gift, Rosie," he said directly to the camera. "Don't ever sell it short. And I'll always be there with you. I'll never, ever leave you." And then this wasted man started to sing to her. "You're the end of the rainbow," he sang, tears spilling down his cheeks. "My pot of gold. Your daddy's little girl to have and hold." On and on he went. It was as pathetic as it was unbelievable. When I asked him, "What if you are found guilty?" he angrily shouted these lines at me. "What do I care? How do you kill a dead man? What are they going to do to me that they haven't done already? They took away my entire past. They took away my entire future. What's left for them to take? They're going to take my testicles and make earrings out of them?" You can't top that. After the interview aired, the judge granted him bail and released him. Blake looked so pale and thin, the judge might have been afraid he would die in jail. Blake thought our interview was the reason he was released. He still says so. In March 2005, Blake was found not guilty of murdering his wife. There was no physical evidence linking him to the murder, and the drug habits and contradictory statements of the retired stuntmen discredited their testimony. Our interview may also have played a small role in his acquittal. Parts of it were played at the trial. At the press conference afterward, Blake publicly thanked me. As for his little daughter, Rosie, she has been adopted by Delina Blake Hurwitz, Blake's older daughter from his first marriage, a professor of developmental psychology. I met her, and she was lovely. Blake did something right. Of all the convicted murderers I interviewed, I was closest to Jean Harris. Too close, in fact, but I'll get to that. She was the most improbable murderer. Harris had been the prim and proper headmistress of an elite school for girls, the Madeira School, in McLean, Virginia. Her victim was her longtime and unfaithful lover, Herman Tarnauer, a well-known cardiologist and author of the best-selling book, The Scarsdale Diet. Harris was 56 when she shot Tarnauer. He was 69. Hardly the age, one would think, for a crime of passion, but that's what it was. Harris, who had been seeing Tarnauer, as she would put it, for 14 years, began to come apart on a Saturday morning in March 1980. An insomniac, she hadn't slept a wink. The day before, she had expelled 4 popular students for smoking pot. The girl's furious parents were at the school berating her, and there was a student protest going on in support of the Madeira 4 outside her window. She had also run out of the antidepressants Tarnauer had been supplying her with for 10 years, but when she phoned him for a new shipment, he added more stress. At one point in their relationship, he had promised to marry her and then backed off. She knew that the lifelong bachelor was having an affair with his young assistant, but Tarnauer rubbed salt in the wound when he now told Harris that she would not be seated on his right at an upcoming tribute to him, nor, indeed, would she even be seated at his table. It was all too much for the already fragile Harris, and after writing Tarnauer a furious letter about the young assistant, she said she prepared to kill herself. But she wanted to have one last conversation with Tarnauer before she died, and the fatal sequence began. On March 10th, Harris put a loaded gun in her purse, bought a bouquet of flowers, and drove 5 hours from Virginia to Tarnauer's house outside New York. It was 10 p.m. and raining when she arrived. He was in bed, to told her he didn't want to talk, and to make matters worse, he turned his back on her. Then she saw a negligee and a pair of slippers in the bathroom and lost it completely. What happened next became the central point of the trial. The defense claimed Harris held the gun to her head, Tarnauer intervened, and in the ensuing struggle, the gun accidentally went off, fatally wounding the cardiologist. The prosecution claimed she had shot the doctor on purpose. Either way, Tarnauer lay dying on the floor from 4 bullet wounds. Harris was arrested, convicted of second-degree murder, and sentenced to 15 years to life. This bare-bones recital of the facts in no way conveys how sensational this case was at the time, and the ripples it caused for years to come. Feminist groups cast Harris as the victim of an uncaring man who threw her over for a younger woman. In their eyes, she shouldn't have been convicted of anything when clearly Tarnauer had been the SOB. Her imprisonment raised such passion that an ad hoc group formed called the Jean Harris Defense Committee, which orchestrated a letter-writing and signature-gathering campaign to petition Governor Mario Cuomo to grant Harris clemency. Every year, as regular as clockwork, he refused. I had written many letters to Mrs. Harris and her lawyer asking for an interview so that she could tell her side of the story. Nearly 2 years after her conviction, she finally consented to sit down with me at the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, a maximum security prison for women in New York. I'll never forget my interview with Harris, the first she'd given. When I met her in prison, she was wearing the same good little girl leather hairband she'd always worn, a white shirt under a beige cable-knit sweater, and still looked very much the schoolmistress. Though she had lost an appeal for a new trial just 2 days before, she was calm and dry-eyed when she sat down with me, until I asked her about Tarnauer. "Do you still love him?" I asked. "Yes," she said. "Do you think about him?" I asked. And then she crumpled and completely broke down. Don't, she sobbed, pushing me away with her hands. I won't, I quickly responded, not wanting to cause her any more pain. Let's talk about your life here a little bit, all right? But Jean Harris wanted to talk about Tarnauer.
I think about him constantly, she said through her sobs. It's one of the reasons I don't care if I get out. I can't imagine what it would be like out there without him. Isn't that stupid?
She recovered, and we went on with the interview. But her wrenching outburst stayed with me for a long time. Here was a woman who was going to spend at least the next 13 years in prison and didn't care about getting out because he was not going to be there. I had rarely witnessed that kind of love and was very moved by it. Harris put her life to good use in prison. In a subsequent interview she and I did at Bedford Hills, she showed me a child care center she'd helped set up where the inmates could read stories or play games with their children when they came to see them. Along with a visiting nun, she taught a class in prison parenting for pregnant inmates and young mothers so they could cope better on the outside. With the nun, she also started the Children of Bedford Foundation to give better educational opportunities to the children of prisoners. Some of those children went to college and even on to law school. Harris suffered a heart attack in jail, and the Jean Harris Defense Committee intensified its efforts to secure her pardon. I signed every petition that came my way and joined the letter-writing campaign to Governor Cuomo, who still refused to release her. Was I the impartial journalist? Yes, in terms of my interviews with Harris, but on my own time, definitely not. I cared about her and thought her 15-year prison sentence was an injustice. ABC, however, and rightly so, did not support my personal involvement in the pardon effort. And soon after, a newspaper columnist wrote about my participation. ABC News told me that I was no longer permitted to report on the case. I continued to visit Harris from time to time, but I was silenced professionally. For the last 9 long years of her incarceration, during which she had another heart attack. It was not until December 1992, when Harris was in the hospital about to undergo quadruple bypass heart surgery,
that Governor Cuomo finally pardoned her, citing her health. She was 69 years old by then and had spent 12 years in prison. Finally, she was a free woman, and so was I to talk on camera with her. Our last interview was in March 1993, 3 months after her heart surgery and her release from prison. Harris looked tired, but had lost none of her spunk. Her answer to my question about what she had found hardest to adjust to in prison was not the strip searches she had been subjected to every time she had a visitor, but rather the lack of logic. For example, her visitors' names had to be submitted in advance and checked off a list by a guard before they could visit her. But some visitors were turned away or had to wait a very long time because the guard couldn't find their names on the list. "I kept saying to them, 'Please let me have the list and I'll arrange it alphabetically for you,' she said. And the guard said to me, 'It won't do any good because they don't come alphabetically.'" When I asked her whether she felt the years in prison had been wasted, she answered, "Not for a minute." She said she was much stronger than when she'd entered prison. "I didn't have a very strong will to live when I went in," she said, "but I have a very strong will to live now." What impressed me the most was the contrast between this interview and our first one, when she'd broken down at the mention of Tarnauer's name and said she thought about him all the time. "Yes, I did, but I don't anymore. That was 12 years ago, and it's over, and it was very painful. What I think about now is all the things that ought to be done to improve the lives of children in this country, and that consumes me." Harris, whose story was portrayed in several books and movies, the most recent was the 2006 HBO film Mrs. Harris, starring Annette Bening and Ben Kingsley, is in her 80s now and lives in an assisted living home in Connecticut. She is close to her two sons by a former marriage, pre-Tarnauer, and has friends. She still raises funds for the Children of Bedford Foundation. I send a contribution. She sent me a little note in the spring of 2007, asking warmly, "When are you going to stop working, and so hard? I'm pretty rickety. Wish I had your energy." I hope that her life is peaceful. I think she has a right to that. Mark David Chapman was not the most famous murderer I interviewed, but he had certainly murdered the most famous person, John Lennon. I had tried for over a decade to get an interview with him, writing him a letter on each anniversary of Lennon's death. It took 12 years for Chapman to say yes, and another few months for the warden, after determining that Chapman was now sane enough, to also agree. I finally met with Chapman in 1992 at Attica Correctional Facility in upstate New York. What made Chapman's interview worth such a long-term effort was that no one had ever heard in his own words why he killed Lennon. There had been no trial, and so no testimony, because Chapman had instructed his lawyer to withdraw his insanity plea and instead plead guilty. The court had sentenced him to 20 years to life, and for his own protection he was being held in an isolated part of the prison. This first television interview with him in 1992, along with the simultaneous publication of a book about him, would break his silence. I remember Chapman, somber, wearing glasses, shuffling toward me in leg irons, his hands cuffed, wearing the bright orange prison jumpsuit I had become very familiar with, and flanked by two burly prison guards. Prison guards always seem to be burly. When he reached the small, bare room the authorities always seemed to assign me and my crew in every prison, he seemed relieved, as would every murderer I interviewed, to sit down and have his cuffs and shackles removed. Like all the others, he was eager to talk. But while Chapman was cogent, very quiet, and seemed perfectly sane, what he said was not. His hatred of Lennon had begun, he told me, when he chanced upon a book about the former Beatle in a library and learned that Lennon was living in an elegant landmark building in New York. "I got very, very angry," he told me. "I used to love the Beatles. Their idealism meant a lot to me, and I saw that, at the time, as a sellout." Chapman, who had been abused as a child, suffered from depression, and had once attempted suicide, bought a gun and a ticket to New York from Hawaii, determined to kill Lennon. "Why?" I asked him. His reply, "John Lennon fell into a very deep hole. A hole so deep inside me that I thought by killing him I would acquire his fame." On the night of December 8, 1980, Chapman waited outside Lennon's apartment building for Lennon to return from a recording session. Chapman had in his pocket a gun and his Bible, J.D. Salinger's A Catcher in the Rye, whose alienated central character Chapman identified with. Somehow Chapman thought killing Lennon would make him feel better. "I see this real somebody who I perceived at the time to be a phony," Chapman told me. "My nobody was wanting to strike down that somebody." This was a man who was deemed mentally sound enough to withdraw his insanity defense? Chapman told me he had asked Satan to give him the power to kill John Lennon. "I turned to Satan because I knew I wouldn't have the strength to kill a man on my own," he said. "So I went through what I thought was an appropriate satanic ritual and took off all my clothes and chanted and screamed and howled." Satan spoke to him later as Lennon's car drew up. "I heard this voice saying over and over, 'Do it, do it, do it, do it.'" And he did. Chapman pumped 4 bullets into John Lennon as the former Beatle walked toward his apartment building. Chapman then leaned against the building and read A Catcher in the Rye until the police arrived and put him in the back of a police car. He didn't seem perturbed by the sight of Lennon lying bleeding on the sidewalk, but was very disturbed by the policeman who was holding Lennon's head and cursing him. "It frightened me to death," Chapman told me. "Here's this police officer mouthing those horrible words at me." Lennon died in the back of a police car as he was being rushed to the hospital. Chapman went to prison, where he told me a priest standing outside the prison walls finally expelled his satanic demons through an exorcism. Chapman concluded the interview by apologizing to Lennon's wife, Yoko Ono, and their son, Sean, who was 5 years old at the time of the murder. "I'm sorry, and I mean that," he said. "I'm sorry, I'm sorry." Our interview was finished, but when the guards put the handcuffs and the leg irons back on and started walking him back toward his cell, he kept turning his head back toward me and saying, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry." His words echoed down the long hall and faded as he neared his cell. I can still hear them. A great many people were upset by this interview, and after we ran it, ABC felt that I had to be very careful about security. I was told to come into the building through a separate entrance because there were so many protesters outside, people who loved John Lennon and were furious that we had given his assassin airtime. But the interview didn't do Chapman any good. As of this writing, he is still in Attica, where he is said to have become an evangelical Christian. He has been denied parole 4 times, due partly to Yoko Ono, who in November 2006, nearing the 26th anniversary of her husband's death, wrote in the New York Times, "I don't know if I am ready yet to forgive the one who pulled the trigger." Nor, it appears, are others. During one parole board hearing, close to 2,000 people signed an online petition threatening retribution were he to be released. Chapman is safer in prison. Finally, the Menendez brothers, who came to me in 1996 via Leslie Abramson, their fiery defense lawyer. The public's fascination with lurid crimes had spawned Court TV in 1991, and like millions of other Americans, I closely followed on my television set the drama Leslie was staging in a Los Angeles courtroom. Her client, Eric Menendez, and his brother Lyle, represented by another attorney, were charged with first-degree murder for brutally shooting their parents in 1989 while they were watching television in their opulent Beverly Hills home. Eric had been 18 and Lyle 21 at the time of the double murders. Their joint trial began 4 years later, but Abramson tried to recapture the brothers' youth by dressing them in sweaters and khaki pants every day of the trial so that they looked younger than their ages. What a drama. We all watched the boys, as Leslie always called them, cry when they testified about the sexual abuse they claimed their father had inflicted on them,
and their shared fear that if they told, he would kill them. Instead, they killed him and their mother. It was clearly self-defense, Leslie laid out in the course of the 5-month trial. The jury ended up deadlocked between those who believed her and pressed for a verdict of manslaughter and those who pressed for first-degree murder, convinced that the boys had killed their parents out of greed to get their hands on the family fortune. The mistrial was a spectacular, though temporary, victory for Leslie and her boys. Their second trial began in 1995 and lasted 7 months. I talked with Leslie throughout both trials. She was a piece of work, small, with masses of curly blonde orphan Annie hair, and a tiger, both inside and outside the courtroom. She infuriated some lawyers and journalists with her shenanigans, but she and I hit it off. Leslie was in the process of trying out for a TV show of her own with one of the networks. It never came to pass, and I gave her some suggestions. What I ultimately wanted, of course, as did absolutely every television journalist, was an interview with the brothers. But I also genuinely liked her. My relationship with her served me well when, after the second trial ended, she advised Eric and Lyle to go with me for the interview. By then, the Menendez brothers had been found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. This is why they were convicted. The brothers already had 2 strikes against them. One, the spending spree they had gone on after their parents' deaths with their father's life insurance policy. Lyle had even bought a gray Porsche 911 Carrera for $64,000. Second, Eric's confession of the murders to his therapist, which was overheard by the therapist's girlfriend and eventually reported to the police. Third, and the tipping point in the second trial, a sharp change in the attitude of the judge. Stung by the criticism of Judge Ito in the controversial O.J. Simpson trial, which had ended in Simpson's acquittal just a week before, the judge in the Menendez trial this time didn't allow television cameras in the courtroom. He also limited testimony from family members and expert witnesses on the boys' claim of sexual abuse on the grounds that no evidence of such abuse had been proved in the first trial. That gave the jury only 2 options, first-degree murder or acquittal. With self-defense no longer an option, first-degree murder it was. Leslie Abramson was so upset about the conviction and so exhausted by the trials that for a period of time she left criminal law. Still, she urged Eric and Lyle to give me their first and exclusive interview. I talked with the Menendez brothers in the Los Angeles County Jail. It was the first time Eric and Lyle had sat next to each other outside the courtroom and told their stories. What awful stories they were. On the night of the murders, Eric told me, I said to myself, I'm never going to let him touch me again. And just before the shootings, my dad told me to get to my room and that he would be there in a minute, and there was going to be sex, and it was like an explosion in my mind. I reminded him that he and his brother had already bought shotguns, but Eric insisted that the guns were for their own protection. When it was revealed I had told Lyle the secret, my dad said to Lyle, "You're going to tell everyone, and I'm not going to let that happen." But why had they killed their mother? Because, the brothers said, she knew and did nothing. "There was anger on my part," said Lyle. "My mother was aware and had to lie to herself about my father," said Eric. "She told me that she knew, that she had known all my life what my father was doing. At that point, I just saw Dad and Mom as the same person. I saw them as a single person." So they shot their parents and, with their inheritance, went shopping. There are people who think you are spoiled brats, that you are evil, that you are monsters. What do you say to them? I asked. And Eric responded with what became my favorite line. "I'm just a normal kid," he said. "Oh, Eric," I said back to him, "you're a normal kid who killed his parents?" The interview took place just before the formal sentencing and the subsequent decision as to which state prison or prisons the brothers would be placed in. They were very anxious to be imprisoned together.
The family that Eric and I grew up in, we had to be there for each other throughout, and it really created a bond that gets us through a very rough period, said Lyle. Eric seemed terrified at the possibility of separation. If we're not put in the same prison, there's a good probability that I will never see him again. With everything taken away, it would be the last they could take. But their pleas didn't sway the authorities. Lyle was sent to the California Correctional Institution near Tehachapi and Eric to the California State Prison in Sacramento County. I gather you know the disaster that occurred a few weeks ago, Eric wrote me in October 1996. Lyle and I were separated. I won't dwell on this unfortunate and cruel decision that was made by whatever powers that be. I am sad. The brothers remain in separate prisons to this day. This was not the first letter I received from Eric. Almost from the time I interviewed him, he had begun to write to me. At first, I didn't answer, but his letters were so intelligent, and he seemed in such emotional pain, stressing again and again how tortured he was by what he had done, that I began to answer him. He told me he had received hundreds and hundreds of letters from people who had been abused by their parents. He tried to answer them, and hoped he could do something to help them, though of course he couldn't. He also had thoughts about prison reform, but the authorities were not interested, he said, and his views were getting him into trouble. Which brings me to an aside I find intriguing. While they were incarcerated, Eric and Lyle both married women on the outside, who were among the hundreds, maybe thousands, who wrote to them during the trials and their subsequent years in prison. Lyle married, divorced in less than a year, and married again. Eric married in 1999, and as of this writing, is still married to one of his prison correspondents, Tammy Menendez. What makes these marriages particularly astonishing is that prisoners like Lyle and Eric are not allowed conjugal visits. In plainer English, no sex. So when Eric wrote to me in 2002, 3 years after his marriage, and suggested that I might want to do an interview with Tammy, I immediately answered that yes, I did. Eric said that his wife was very afraid of talking. She had been asked to leave her volunteer job when her colleagues found out she was Mrs. Eric Menendez, but he would tell her that it was a good idea. He kept hoping and trying to get his case reopened, this time using the restricted material relating to his parental abuse. Perhaps he felt an interview with the sympathetic Tammy would help win him a new trial. So I flew to California to meet Tammy. 10 years Eric Sr., twice married, and a mother of two daughters, one grown and one 6 years old. Tammy was fragile, blonde, very pretty, and shy. After we got to know each other a bit, we went together to visit Eric in prison. It was a bizarre meeting. I had been in enough prisons by then to know to bring quarters for the vending machine, and we sat there, the three of us, eating hamburgers and having a conversation as if we were in McDonald's. I remember thinking how well Eric looked. He had been incarcerated for 12 years by then, but he was tanned and fit. It turned out he was a night janitor in the prison and by day worked out with plastic bags filled with water as weights. He and Tammy were very sweet together. They could hold hands during the visit, but no other contact was allowed. I later interviewed Tammy outside the prison. We couldn't film the couple together because on-camera interviews with inmates weren't allowed. Tammy told me that it was during the brothers' first televised trial that her heart went out to Eric, that she could understand what he went through. Had she been abused herself, I asked. In my marriage, I was emotionally starved, she said. He was just not there for me at all. Tammy would later disclose in a book about her relationship with Eric that her then-husband had been molesting her older daughter, his stepdaughter. He subsequently committed suicide. Tammy wrote to Eric in prison during the trial. To her surprise, he responded. After her husband's death in 1996, she waited several months before she wrote again. This time, she says, she needed support from him. When I asked her why she trusted Eric when she had never met him, she replied, "Maybe because he was incarcerated. He was very safe for me."
They met for the first time the following summer, when Tammy went to California to visit Eric.
I was scared, she said. I'd never been in a prison before.
Sparks flew.
I was just thinking, I am really attracted to this person, and it's not a good thing because he's incarcerated. And we visited again, and things just kept getting more intense.
She finally moved from Minnesota with her younger daughter to be near Eric's prison. The couple married in 1999 in a cinder block conference room next to the prison's visiting hall. Eric's grandmother came, as did two of his aunts, one from each side of the family. They weren't allowed to have a wedding cake.
We had Twinkies from the vending machine, Tammy said,
but the prison did make one concession.
They allowed us to kiss each other after the wedding, so that was nice, Tammy said.
Eric seemed as devoted to Tammy as she was to him. We were able to interview him by phone, though we couldn't show him.
I can't offer her most of the things another husband can in terms of being with her physically and being able to hold her, he said. What I can offer her is unconditional and complete devotion and love. She's everything to me.
The interview seemingly got Eric in more trouble. Both he and Tammy wrote me that soon afterward he'd been taken away in handcuffs and locked in the hole. He spent 4 days in an isolation cell, Tammy wrote, with blood, feces, and food scattered about, before he found out why. He'd been charged with conspiracy to escape. He passed a polygraph test and was eventually released from lockdown, but there were other repercussions. Eric has since been transferred 4 hours away to Pleasant Valley State Prison in Coalinga, California, and Tammy can only visit him on weekends. Lyle has been moved, too, to Mule Creek State Prison in Ione, California. Each brother has appealed his sentence, but to no avail. Eric's worst fears have played out. The brothers haven't been allowed to see or speak to each other in more than a decade. They can write to each other, but the letters are opened and read by the authorities. Eric writes to me to this day. He is the only convicted murderer I've stayed in touch with. Do I think what he did was hideous? Yes, of course. Does he think what he did was hideous? Yes, at least he says so. His letters are intelligent, sensitive, and uncomplaining. Eric will probably never be released from prison, and I wonder again and again how this man I have just described as intelligent and sensitive could have cold-bloodedly shot both of his parents to death. As I've said before about Eric and all the murderers I've interviewed, I can feel empathy toward them as human beings, but I just cannot comprehend their crimes.